Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, Stat Waddy Gaming, who's going first?
Shall I go first?
Go on.
All right, okay. So, album titles that were considered and eventually abandoned.
All right. Good one.
So, The Queen is Dead by The Smiths. At one stage, it was going to be called... Here's four examples. One of them is fictitious.
Okay.
Queen is Dead, at one stage, it's going to be called Margaret on the Guillotine.
Okay.
Caribou by Elton John. One stage going to be called Old Pink Eyes is Back. Low by David Bowie. The notion was to call it New Music, Night and Day.
This is good.
Sunshine on Leith by The Proclaimers was at one stage going to be called Super Cali Go Ballistic. Celtic are atrocious.
No. Go on.
And Hail to the Thief by Radiohead was going to be called The Bony King of Nowhere.
Okay. Well, that's all very good. But The Proclaimers is the wrong one.
Is that an obvious ringer?
Well, I don't think it ever was a newspaper headline, was it?
There was a newspaper headline for Inverness Caledonian Thistle's shock 3-1 victory against Celtic in the Scottish Cup. It really was a real headline.
Okay, so it was going to be. Okay, have I identified the right one? Okay.
Rather too quickly.
It's a good category. Very good category.
But you can imagine that Margaret on the Guillotine would have been.
Absolutely. That's a shoo-in for
us. Pink Eyes is basically.
Of course. Yeah, okay, here we go. Krautrock.
Okay.
One of them is not real. These are all krautrock groups. One of them's not real. Okay. Cluster with a K.
Yep.
Frumpy.
Yep.
Energy Cottbus. Agitation Free. And Embryo. Cluster, Frumpy, Energy Cottbus, Agitation Free, and Embryo.
God, I'm saying, well, Frumpy is so ridiculous, it must be true. Energy Clock Bus also is so extraordinarily complicated and dramatic. That's true, too. And was it Agitation Free?
Yeah.
That's just odd, so that's true, too. Embryo, possibly false. I'm saying, to be honest, I think the one you've made up, though, is Cluster.
I went.
No, you're kidding.
Cluster's real. The Energy Cottbus is a German football team.
Oh, no, you're kidding. That's fantastic. Very good work indeed.
So very good. Okay.
No, I've been you know, absolutely humiliated there.
No,
disastrous performance.
Because we did a special Word in Your they say it's your birthday recording this week. We did a couple of them actually, didn't we? We did one with Jeff Rees.
Yeah,
and he was the first person to come on and say
he sprung some on us.
And spring a Stat Waddy game on us, which we had to spot. We had to spot the ringer amongst five Welsh groups because Jeff's Welsh. It was a very good idea.
It was really good.
So if anybody finds themselves...
I think everybody has a Stat Waddy about their person.
Yeah, they do. There's probably some area that they specialize made a special study on. So I tell you what I watched on telly. I don't watch a lot of telly, as I've bored you with it in the past. But I found myself gripped in a horrific way on Friday night by turning on the telly, and there was Cliff Richard's Summer Holiday on.
Oh, yeah, I saw a bit of that. Yeah, yeah.
To mark his 80th birthday.
That's right.
And I don't think I've actually seen Summer Holiday since 1963, which is when it came out. And I just found it I watched it with horrified fascination, I think it's fair to say. Because I always thought it was a fairly kind of straightforward, you know, pop jaunt round Europe on a double-decker bus, such as might be undertaken by any bunch of bus garage employees in the year 1963. And, you know, so my memories were all related to the bus and going out the garage and all that kind of stuff. And what I found instead was that it was plunged into this bizarre kind of travelogue around Europe, containing all kinds of strange pastiches of musical comedy items. Do you see this?
I saw about half of it. I know, it wasn't extraordinary, because I thought it was a movie. I remember it as being a movie like Hard Day's Night, which is kind of a movie punctuated by pop songs. But it's not. It's a full-on American-style musical where suddenly a factory floor at the bus factory or a French square or highway is transformed into mass choreography. And not just kind of voguish twist action, but there's kind of waltzing and calypso. And it's pure family entertainment, isn't it? You know,
It is.
It made me wonder if there was ever a time when Cliff was even vaguely hip.
That's the interesting thing is that there's nothing in it where the filmmakers, and it's made by Peter Yates, who subsequently was quite a distinguished director. He directed Bullet, the Steve McQueen film, loads of other things. And, you know, it was made with a lot of know-how and obviously quite a lot of budget. But they must never have thought, we're going to aim this at some notional youth audience. You know, there was no sense that this is what
it's not what the kids are up to. It's a mass market family entertainment.
It's all about what the kids could do if they embraced the glory of family entertainment.
Yeah.
And there's the most bizarre sequence takes place, I think, is it Austria or something? It's supposed to be Tyrolean, I think, anyway. As part of their journey, when they're going all the way down to Greece, aren't they?
Yeah,
ending up in Athens, and it has a whole production number, which I see is referred to on the soundtrack as really waltzing, and basically, it's a Viennese waltz number based on a recent hit film came out in 1962 called White Horse Hotel, which had probably been really popular with my mum and dad's generation, you know, who were not going to go and see Summer Holiday. But there's Cliff and, you know, Eunice Stubbs and all the gang dressed up in all this stuff, doing a kind of sub Strauss waltz number. It's absolutely strange.
It's completely bizarre. Because I agree, I thought it was aimed at pop pickers. Granny would enjoy it, you know. The whole mass multi-generational thing, isn't it?
Except Granny would probably say, I'll tell you what, doesn't Gene Kelly do this kind of thing slightly better?
Yeah.
Can he dance a bit better than Cliff Richard? Yes, he probably could. And so the production numbers, as you say, it's kind of French parks bursting into bizarre life and song, you know, and a really long kind of mime spoof number featuring Ron Moody.
Ron Moody, exactly.
Ron Moody.
None more 60s light entertainment. Yeah.
Now, much as I love Ron Moody, but you think, what is this doing in this film? It is, you know, it's like, you know, it's a strange watch. You know, if you've got nothing better to do on one of these gloomy winter days, it's probably on the BBC iPlayer.
I was gripped by it, actually. Yeah, it's sort of fascinating. You think, how can this possibly be? You know, and Cliff is absurdly wooden and cheesy, but somehow weirdly entertaining, actually. I quite enjoy it.
He's oddly likable, I think.
Yeah, he is.
And, anybody who survived that long, you think, hats off, for goodness sake.
Absolutely.
At the top of your tree, you know, who are we to carp? But he is kind of wooden, you know.
Completely.
But he's also, as I discovered many years ago, I don't know quite how many years ago it was, when I happened to be on Centre Court Wimbledon, when he rose from the crowd to...
Oh, you were there, weren't you? I remember. Yes.
to entertain.
Because it was all across various all the BBC, all other channels. They were saying, turn over to BBC One and watch Wimbledon.
Because, well, because it was,
what,
you know...
What happened? It was raining or something.
There was some rain delay or something, some weather delay. It was probably in the days before the retractable roof and all that kind of thing. Mind you, they need hours to retract roofs. And so Cliff was there, as Cliff very often is, you know, wearing one of his many kind of many summer jackets that always look, you know, he always, I always felt that Cliff came from the same tailor as Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett. You know, there's, if you want a powder blue sports jacket,
powder blue, he's slightly he's linen,
lime green,
sleeves kind of shunted up slightly,
yeah. Tangerine, all your favorite colors, they'll all be there. And no, but he was big tennis fan, player, supporter, a patron. And he always turned up at Wimbledon every year. It was a big deal for Cliff Richard. And he was always turned out in this particular kind of gear. And he rose from the crowd. So he got to a microphone and he entertained the crowd, if I can put it that way, with a bunch of...
He did Living Doll, he did Summer Holiday. He did All Shook Up, I think.
Well, I mean, I can't remember the set list. I just remember my awed fascination. I'm just looking across and like, good grief. Why would he do this? Because can you think of another popular musical entertainer who would do that? Paul McCartney's not going to get up and send and give you...
Because he's going to think that would be grotesquely gauche. And he really would. Self-interested.
Is Elton John getting it? No, he's not going to. You know, they're not without a piano or anything. You know, where's Cliff? There's just something about him. He's kind of, he's unsinkable. He's unembarrassable.
No, he's programmed to do it. He's just hardwired.
And so, you know, I'm sure a lot of people got a lot of pleasure from it. You know, fair enough. I tell you the other thing that struck me watching Summer Holiday. What a strange but really kind of, persistent song Summer Holiday is. You know, is there anybody in the country who couldn't sing Summer Holiday to you? You know,
well, partly revived by things like the Young Ones, wasn't it? But, yeah, you know, the whole Cliff concept kind of came back in the early 80s. But, yeah, it's really enduring, isn't it? It's also, I think, really good.
That's what I mean.
We're going where the sun shines brightly. We're going where the sea is blue. We've seen it in the movies. So let's see if it's true. See, I grew up, my family, we never went abroad, actually. We always went to drizzly coastlines in the UK for our holidays.
Is that a special place? Daddy, are we going to drizzly again?
Drizzly coastlines, yeah.
Can we go Can we see it yet?
That's right, I know. The idea then that of France and Italy and stuff was incredibly exotic and rather romantic, wasn't it?
Oh, well, we'd had our first overseas holiday, I think, in 1961. So we're slightly ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
But that was 2 weeks in a dormobile kind of camper van thing, during which we did, I think, 7 countries.
We had one of those. We had a Bedford dormobile. It was the same one with the sliding door. And, yeah.
Well, horrible thing. Yeah,
that's the one.
And did he used to have the engine? Was the engine canopy between the two seats in the front? I think it would have been.
It was, and there's a strong smell of diesel. That's all I can remember.
We used dry beachwear on the engine canopy while ploughing through the Dolomites in Italy. Can we stop, Dad? No, we've got to get to Milan.
We've got to get his towel dry.
No, but it was seven countries.
Not until the socks are ready to put on again.
We did France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Italy, and back.
God,
2 weeks.
In a dormobile.
In a bloody dormobile. So a Cliff Richard bus would have been quite luxurious as compared to that, you know. But no, the song Summer Holiday, hats off to those who wrote it. Foremost amongst them, Bruce Welch. And
Jim Harris?
No, the drummer, Brian Bennett. Very good work. And no doubt very
Bruce
good.
Well, surely must be still coining from that, mustn't he?
Well, probably a decent decent living will come in via that. Talking of which, I was I was speaking only the other day to a neighbour of mine, Maurice Bacon, who is around about my age, and was the original drummer in The Love Affair. Remember The Love Affair?
Yes, indeed. Everlasting Love.
1968, Everlasting Love. Yeah, yeah. Love on a Mountaintop, I think, and another one I can't remember.
Steve Ellis was the singer.
And he was telling me that he still gets, you know, they get a check every year from CBS or whatever. You know, how long ago is that? Well,
that's incredible.
Know, it's, was it 50?
£17.23.
Well, no, I know he said it's worth having. It's worth having, you know, just for a kind of day's work in 1968. It's absolutely astonishing. And he was telling me that when Everlasting Love went to number one, when it was number one in the UK in 1968, he was 16 years old.
That amazing.
Because we talked to Morgan Fisher, didn't we? In one of the Word in Your Attics, who was also a member of Love Affair. I think he'd left at that point, but he came back later on. And he was probably around about the same age. So 16 years old. And I was reminded.
But you've been reading that book about Peter Frampton, haven't you? Do You Feel Like I Do? The memoir, which has just come out, Peter Frampton's memoir. And that's what struck me, was that he was so young. You know, Peter Frampton was at school, age 15, when he was offered a job in The Preachers, who were managed by, and I think produced by, Bill Wyman. Am I right?
Oh, yes, that's right.
Bill Wyman, obviously being very well connected with Ready, Steady, Go, got them on Ready, Steady, Go. And so at the age of 15, while still at school, he's on national television. It's incredible, isn't it? Age 16, he joined The Herd. I mean, you know, Billy Gaff had offered him a job. It's a brilliant bit where his dad negotiates a fee for him. His dad works out that the minimum wage at the time is £15 a week.
Yes, he insists.
And he insists that his son cannot join this group. And they say, OK. So they put him on £15 a week, which is actually slightly more than the others are getting. But a bit later, they got a residency at the Marquee and they're all making £35 a week. But he's still contracted to be on £15 a week. he very much regrets his father's decisions. But, I mean, it's just it's an extraordinary story, isn't it? Well, 16 years old. He was on TV 3 years before. I think was it 3 years before David Bowie was? David Bowie, who was 3 years old.
Oh, you mean? I really.
He's made from school.
Because his dad, Peter Frampton's dad, was the art teacher, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he was the art teacher who taught David Bowie. It's a reminder that story. And talking to Morris the other day and thinking about the Amen Corner. That 1968 was the kind of second great age of screaming in Britain, I seem to remember. You know, and so you had groups like Amen Corner, The Herd, Love Affair, and I don't know, possibly the Tremolos. I don't know, maybe they weren't cute enough. Maybe they were, I don't know. Who used to attract hordes of absolute really noisy screaming girls. And so literally they couldn't hear themselves play. But they were immensely popular and they all had absolutely huge hits because I suppose all the other groups were suddenly growing their hair long and growing beards and trying to be interesting and deep and fascinating. And so there was a great gap for anybody who came along with a singable, whistleable tune who had a cute lead singer. That was one of the key things. And of course, Peter Frampton in The Herd was the cutest one of all, and famously described as the face of 1968 by I can't remember.
Which caused all sorts of problems. It really interested me reading that whole section about how much in those days, how much creative control the management had, because they were managed by Billy Gaff, and then they were taken over by Ken Howard and Alan Blakely,
who
wrote "Have I the Right for the Honeycombs." He wrote all those Dave D. Dozy hits. And they just said, right, we're the managers, you're the singer, you're going out the front, which Peter Frampton didn't think he ought to be. He seemed to think that there were two people better qualified for this job. And they organised that. They turned him into the star at the front, quite rightly, actually. They wrote Absolutely. I Can Fly, they wrote From the Underworld. Yeah, then he was they had all these hits. As you say, there was a piece by, was it by...
Was it Penny Valentine? It might have been.
Saying he was for Disc and Music Echo, saying he was the face of 1968. Of course, unbelievable friction in the group and pretty much began the disintegration of the group.
Yeah. It's a classic case, that, because I wouldn't mind betting that Penny Valentine or whoever wrote the thing never wrote the words Face of 68 ever. That would have been done by a sub.
Yeah, the sub, and the editor would have put that on.
And that's the thing that everybody remembers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And no doubt she had to spend ages apologizing for it afterwards. So nothing you can do about it. And, you know, he was stuck with that ever since. And so, you know, his name can never be mentioned in all the many years since without that being mentioned. We're doing it again.
That's absolutely.
We're doing it again.
Immortalized.
But I'm interested in the subject of handsomeness in rock, and he was terribly handsome, or terribly cute, wasn't he? Before he was handsome,
ridiculously handsome.
He's got a model cute, which is slightly a problem in rock and roll. It almost strikes me that if you can be too, can you be too good looking for rock and roll? Discuss. You see, I think, you know, Jim Morrison, just too good looking, makes people suspicious. Am I right in saying
In what
that?
Way suspicious?
Well, you just think there's something about rock and roll that makes the people think that they ought to appear to be fellow strugglers like...
Yeah, it doesn't look lived in. That's right.
You know,
hasn't suffered.
Somebody like Mick Jagger, who kind of made himself good looking by he redefined good looks, it's like, strikes me, Mick Jagger, you know. He said, no, I'm really good looking. Yes, me, with the big mouth that my mother used to describe as always a mouth like a set pot.
That's right.
Never understood.
Not sure what that is, but...
I never, ever. It's every great. Time they appear on television, oh, she's got a mouth like a set pot. And so he redefined good looks, whereas Peter Frampton looks as if he was a prisoner of good looks. You know what I mean? That...
throughout the book, he complains about it, doesn't he? He complains about the fact that he's put on the cover of Rolling Stone when he's got the solo album out with no shirt on. It's almost as if he was tricked into doing this, you know. And all I want to do is play jazz and play blues, and now I've been turned to this pop idol. It's all ghastly, and girls scream at me. And you think, mate, please.
Mate.
Methinks you do protest too much.
No, it's got loads of reminders of the other things that... bands do when they get a few quid, particularly in those days. And so when he signed with Humble Pie, they got advances for the albums. I think he said we'd all gotten $25,000 each year for 4 years, so we all bought cars. I bought a 1965 Aston Martin DB5, the James Bond model. Steve got a DB6. Greg Ridley out of Spooky Tooth got a Bentley Continental. Yeah, what's he going to do with a Bentley Continental? Where's he going to put it? And Jerry Shirley, the drummer, got a Rolls Royce. You know,
you had to, though, didn't you?
Well, it's interesting, but I was reading...
Status symbol.
I was reading recently, rereading Ian Hunter's Diary of a Rock Star, Rock and Roll Star, for my book about bands, you know, because it writes a lot about the Motley Hoople touring in the United States. And I think he wrote, it came out in 74 or something, but I think he wrote it in 1972. It's based on a tour in 1972, I think. So he goes off on the tour to America, and he asks a mate to look after his car while he's away. And okay, this is my question to you, Mark Ellen. What kind of car did Ian Hunter have in 1972? This is Ian Hunter with the mad hair and the big shades and, you know, all the young dudes and all the way from Memphis. Although, what kind of car?
Well, you'd expect him to have an E-type Jag. But you're going to tell me it was some kind of really prosaic, old-fashioned... It's an Austin Cambridge.
He had a Ford Anglia.
No, I wasn't far off. That's right.
No, an Austin Cambridge was quite big, kind of... Ford bloody Anglia. That's absolutely extraordinary.
Incredible.
When Jerry Shirley was going out buying a Bentley or a Rolls Royce or whatever it was. But the other person who's mentioned a lot in this book, and I think he's mentioned quite liberally now that he's dead, is D'Antoni.
Oh, D'Antoni. The D'Antoni story is amazing, isn't it? Because he's not made much money out of the herd. He's made some, but not that much, he feels. And then they go to Humble Pie and they expect to make huge amounts of cash. Hire D'Antoni in order to crack America. D'Antoni's three rules of success were get the money, remember to get the money, and don't forget to always remember to get the money. That's good, isn't it? It's
very good advice still. That's to this great. Day, I would have thought.
And actually, he had some... He didn't really succeed with Humble Pie. He didn't really deliver for them. But he did when he was managing Frampton as a solo artist. Then it worked out, didn't it?
But he'd say, D'Antoni, I saw Humble Pie a few times. And D'Antoni was always in evidence. He was always there whenever they played.
Yeah.
I saw him at Walthamstow Tech or whatever it was down the road from here, and this would be in 1971 probably, and he was always there at the side of the stage. He looked like Benny the Ball out of Top Cat, you know, slightly rounded figure, and he got a large cigar, you know, and he looked like an archetype of a slightly intimidating American manager figure. But it's quite interesting if you look into him. He died in 2009, I think. He was one of those guys who came up. His friend from school was a kind of saloon singer called Jerry Vale, and he managed him. And then he ended up managing Tony Bennett. You know, he graduated to managing Tony Bennett. And so what he brought to rock and roll when he started...
You know, Jethro Tull, didn't he? And later on, did Jay Gale's band, I think. And Devo?
Jay Gale's band.
ELP, possibly?
I think possibly ELP in America, certainly part of the time. But it's interesting that what he brought to all these acts was an understanding of showmanship. And so he would go along... watch Humble Pie, you know, as he did at the early days, and he said, all right, let me tell you what the good songs are. You know, I don't care what the ones are that you want to play. These are the ones that work. And he's the one that said, Hallelujah, I Just Love It So, which they did was a Ray Charles song. And he said, no, you start with that, you know what I mean? And he told them so much kind of about pacing, about how to deal with a room. And if you watch the Jay Giles band, you know, pretty much the same vintage, they gathered an awful lot of this stuff as well, you know. And so everybody, British acts who made it in the States, had to understand showmanship, had to understand how they hit the back of the room, you know, which is what people like Jethro Tull were really good at. Because I'm going off on a slight tangent here. Phil Manzanera...
That's good.
Phil's Manzanera talks about when Roxy Music first went to the States, which I think probably 72 or maybe 73. And they came trailing Clowns of Glory. You know, they were huge in Britain. They could do no wrong. And they ended up supporting Jethro Tull at Madison Square Garden. You know, and they just went on and did their thing and died like a louse in a Russian's beard. You know? And didn't really make it in America until the 80s, I think. But Phil Manzanera says afterwards, he realized he went and watched Jethro Tull afterwards, and he just realized it's a different game.
A lot to learn.
It's
totally.
Boy, I've got a lot to learn.
Yeah, because you know, you can be one thing in a little club in London, and suddenly you've got to project to 18,000 people. Unbelievable.
You've got to let people know what you're doing, you know, and take them.
Everything you do has got to be very slightly exaggerated.
Yeah, absolutely. Slowed down.
The E Street Band is so good at. There's a great quote in that Frampton book. Sorry, going back to that for a second, from Cameron Crowe, where he says it was like Frampton's talking about his success with Frampton Comes Alive, which was it the biggest selling record at the time? It was, wasn't it?
It was. It was huge.
I think. Huge. Before Thriller and all that. He said it was like Frampton was strapped to the nose cone of a rocket and shot into space. He landed on the moon, and when he got out, there was nobody else there. That was really good.
Good line.
Because he just kind of, there were no maps for that kind of success.
No.
And actually, I think Frampton's pretty well preserved, somebody who went through all that. I mean, it was astonishing. And it was D'Antoni whose idea it was, wasn't it, to put out the live album.
That was D'Antoni's. Solution to the problem of how do you break acts who don't really have hit singles? You do live albums.
Yeah.
And he did it with Jay Giles, and, you know, and he did it with Humble Pie, and later on did it with Peter Frampton. It's quite interesting. He also talks about in this, talk about the Humble Pie live album, Rockin' the Fillmore. Rock on. Have I got my copy? Can I reach my copy? I don't think I'm not quick enough. I think I can. Yeah, I've got it here. There you go.
Very good. That's great.
Humble Pie. Performance, Rocking the Fillmore.
That's great.
With loads of pictures on the back of them on stage. Of course, you wanted nothing more than loads of pictures of
completely.
Them on stage. That's all you want.
Total fantasy.
That's the perfect album sleeve.
It is.
You can't get anything better than that.
But men smoking cigarettes. Men with cigarettes and the machine heads of their guitars.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bottles of Jack Daniels on their amps.
Yeah. And he talks about when D'Anthony, I think, first heard it and heard the other mixes, and said, "Where's the audience?" And basically, it had originally been mixed so you could hear the music. She said, "No, I want to hear the audience. I want to hear the excitement." So they went back and remixed it. So you listen to it now like you listen to loads of those successful live albums at the time, and what you get such a really strong sense of is the audience. And that was so exciting.
Incredibly exciting.
The notion of the audience. So, yeah. So that's what happens with live albums in the early 70s, I suppose. That they're kind of produced. They're produced like movies. They're movies that you can't see, aren't they? You know, it's that sense of drama, you know. That they very often open with the sound of a crowd.
Oh, really? That's just the thing I remember so distinctly when it came out. The sound of the Bangladesh audience. Yeah, you know, it's a lad to bring on a friend of his all, Mr. Bob Dylan, and that incredible sound. It's a thrill of just wishing you'd been there. It's absolutely amazing.
My favourite bit from that time used to be his terrible record, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's Four Way Street, their live album. The best bit of it is Neil Young doing Cowgirl in the Sand, just acoustically. And you just hear him playing the first few chords. And then his voice just starts, "Hello, Cowgirl in the Town." And the audience just go, "Whoa!"
Yeah.
And it's massively exciting, you know. And you just wish you'd been there and wish you could have relived it. But Frampton. So and then he found
what a
out
story, Frampton.
That D'Anthony was taking 20%.
Oh, yeah.
20% of his gross, not the net, 20% of the gross. So he had to keep out on the road, you know. That's how the manager pays for his beach house and all that kind of stuff. But he
opens. There's all sorts of suggestions that there are kind of mafia people involved.
It's not suggestions. He says it.
There's a bit in Humble Pie where they run into two other managers because Steve Marriott decided he wants to leave. And Steve Marriott is physically threatened to the point where he just doesn't dare leave the group. I mean, it's pretty pretty hard-headed management. And this is Steve Marriott. He's been through Don Arden already, so he's got some experience in this kind of thing.
Yes, that's honestly true. That's true.
The sad moment on the Frampton thing is where he records on All Things Must Pass. He's rung up by George Harrison. He's come and play on my new album. Oh, and he's on All Things Must Pass and all the sessions. Never gets credited on the album. Heartbroken.
What, just name missed off?
Yeah, just missed his name off.
Oh, that's poor.
I know, it is pretty poor.
That was the days of shabby album credits.
You know
Mandolin Wind, my Rod Stewart from Every Picture Tells a Story, which is a lot of it is owed to the mandolin player.
Yeah.
You know, it has a mandolin introduction and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And who never gets a credit, I assume.
He says all the credits. Again, I wish I got it here. I've got it here somewhere. It says a mandolin on Mandolin Wind is played by the bloke out of Lindisfarne. Can't remember his name.
You're kidding. That's appalling.
That's how things
it's almost a court case.
Well, I think it's Ray Jackson who was the mandolin player in Lindisfarne. And I think subsequently has, let's say, sought restitution.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Okay, we're back. And any other business, and we're joined by Alex Gold. Alex, I've actually found the Rod Stewart Every Picture Tells a Story album cover. And the credit goes, The mandolin was played by the mandolin player in Lindisfarne. The name slips my mind.
Nice. That's mean, isn't it?
It's and I was just
shabby.
I'm issuing this challenge to people out there.
Yeah.
Are these the shabbiest sleeve credits you've ever seen anywhere on a pop
yes.
record? Because also he spells Ian McLagan's name wrong. Okay. He's a member of the Faces. Spells Madeline Bell's name wrong. And can't even be bothered to find out what's the name of the mandolin player in Lindisfarne. And nobody else looking at it at any point in the proofing process goes, Rod, it's actually Ray Jackson. Shall we put it in? They just leave it as it is.
The intern was fired shortly afterwards, I'd imagine.
So
terrified to take it up with him, I think. You know, if Rod Stewart says that's what he wants, that's what he wants. It's his album.
Or what is it, the ELO record that we were talking about recently? The second ELO record? Is it ELO? Whose record came out in the States under the name No Title.
That's right. Because somebody rang up and said, what's the name of the record? They said,
it has no title.
It's got no title. It's No Title. That's right.
No Title is what it was. Yeah. So, Alex, how are you doing? You're right?
All right, yeah. Not so bad.
Do you think it's possible to be too handsome for rock and roll? Has this ever bothered you at any point?
It hasn't bothered me personally.
Have you ever gone in the group with a person and thought, I'm not lining up with him. He's too good looking.
Well, you see, I've got a theory that it's okay to be too handsome if you're slightly to the side
of the group. You mean?
Yeah. So
if you're number two.
I mean,
so if you're not the front man, that's all right. That's interesting. That's interesting.
Give us some examples of people who are too handsome at the side.
I would say examples from sort of my little plot of time would be Carl Barat from the Libertines.
Oh, right, okay.
Who at the time was sort of, you know, number two, let's face it. But he was gorgeous and he was acceptable because he wasn't right in the middle.
Okay, that's good.
Nick Valencia of the Strokes, who was unfeasibly handsome.
He was the guitarist,
so I was allowed to be. Julian Casablancas, the singer, had some, you know, he was very good looking, but a little bit quirky as well. You know, Nick on the side was model handsome, but he had the green card because he wasn't in the middle.
See, model handsome is the way to look at it, isn't it? That is different. It's a different kind of handsome, isn't it, than rock star. I'm thinking of a similar example from an earlier generation. I don't know if Mark would agree with this. When Klaus Voormann joined Manfred Mann, he was really good looking, but he played the bass.
It sort of
didn't matter that he was better looking than Paul Jones because he wasn't the guy.
Like John Paul Jones and Led Zeppelin, best looking member of the group by some margin.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, okay, fine.
Keith Moon, not flashy.
Keith Moon, best looking member of The Who.
That's true.
Yeah.
Again,
that's true. Keith Moon, before he was dissipated, really good looking, Keith Moon.
Amazing looking.
Yeah.
Really striking.
Before the bloat.
Yeah, that's right.
Terrible victim of the bloat. So, you know, if anybody's got any further suggestions for model handsome guys who are off to the side of the group, I think it's an interesting seam. So what have we got to housekeeping? Have we got any housekeeping we have to do?
We've got a few shows coming up. We've got Billy Bragg. We're doing A Word in Your Attic, aren't we?
We are.
On Wednesday. We're interviewing the guy who wrote the, Andy Neeler wrote the fantastic.
Can you lift
there
it?
There it is, in fact. Oh. Can You Lift It? The Ready Steady Go book.
That's
is amazing. Wow. It's an amazing book. Really extraordinary. Real labour of love.
It really is exceptional.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that. And what have we done in the last week? We spoke to Rob Halford out of Judas Priest about his autobiography, and that's up on YouTube now and usual places. But the way this whole thing works, we do all kinds of things. We do podcasts, we do video casts, we do quizzes, all kinds of things. But there's only one way to make sure that you get all of this stuff. And you get it before anybody else, and that's to sign up, be a supporter on Patreon. And if you want to know about that, just go to patreon.com/wordinyourear and find out more details, as these people have done in the last few days, I think. Alex, can you tell us?
Indeed, we have some new recruits. We have Peter Pettit and Royston Vince, for both annual patrons, and it's worth mentioning that if you subscribe annually, you get a hefty 15% discount. We have Paul Conahan, Alan Wallace, who is an Access All Areas patron. Of course, with the Access All Areas tier, you get your very own Word in Your Attic.
Word in Your Attic for your
On your birthday.
On your birthday.
There's a special. We come to your home digitally. And allow you to go through your
Fear not, collection. Readers, we don't come in fact. We come digital.
Terrible thought. There's sort of rapping on your door.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's like Danny Baker with a packet of Daz.
That's right.
It's not what everybody's looking for, is it, really?
No, it's not.
And we have Nick Deeves.
Right. Welcome all of them. And I hope they'll be joining us for the Friday night quiz. Coming up next Friday, as usual, and see if they can enter the competition and climb the leaderboard amongst the other great rock brains that we have assembled on Friday evenings. What are we all doing this week? We're all just sitting at home, aren't we? Is that right? Is anybody doing anything?
As is the nation, as is the world. Yeah.
Are you going anywhere, Alex? Are you?
I'm going to Leamington today, actually, to drop off a CD that I need mastering. But I might as well be going to the Riviera. You know, it feels really exciting.
You're that excited.
Oh, yeah.
You got up early, got dressed. It's so exciting to go out. I can't wait. Okay, so, we'll see you on the other side.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.